Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, the deadline has come and passed. Governor Newsom signed nearly 1,000 bills into law, 997 to be exact. But others were stopped in their legislative tracks. Newsom vetoed 169 bills, amounting to roughly 14.5%. Collectively, the outcome of the legislative session has a larger tone and message of the governor's priorities and perhaps political ambitions. Emily Hoven writes the Daily What Matters newsletter for Cal Matters and joins us with a comprehensive roundup of some of the bigger surprises as well as the larger message about how these new laws reflect California. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so a veto rate of 14.5%, how does that fare to the governor's previous years?
Yeah, so it's one of the higher veto rates that he's had. His first year in office, he vetoed about 16.5% of bills. That was in 2019. And then obviously in 2020 and 2021, the pandemic hit and that kind of messed up the legislative process. And so lawmakers actually sent much fewer bills to his desk overall because they really had to focus on what they were trying to do with the pandemic. And so he had rates those years of about 13% and about 8%, respectively. And so, you know, this is definitely one of the higher ones. And what I think is interesting is that the governor's office is not hiding that fact. In fact, they're actually somewhat celebrating it. They put out a very interesting press release yesterday in which they touted the fact that he had vetoed about 170 bills and said that in doing so, he had saved taxpayers billions of dollars.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I got that release as well. So where is California financially? I mean, the past couple of years, we've had a record surplus.
Yeah, it's one of we're in the middle of sort of this economic roller coaster because for the past couple of years, we have been basically drowning in surplus money. We've had massive budget surpluses, and this has allowed the governor and the Democratic legislature to direct a lot of money to safety net programs and some of their longstanding priorities, including expanding healthcare to more undocumented immigrants, things of that nature. But now I think nationally with the war going on, the stock market is kind of going through ups and downs. And the richest Californians who contribute most of the state's income tax are, you know, kind of being a little bit more reticent with that. And so Newsom, in many of his veto messages, has repeatedly warned that the state could be on the cusp of, you know, potentially a fiscal downturn. And because of that, they need to be budgeting things very responsibly. And so that was kind of an unusual turn from the way things have been going for the past couple of years. But I think it underscores that the governor does not want to be in the position, if he wins another term here in November, to be slashing government programs.
Yeah, I mean, before we dive into these specific bills, because they're so widespread, I mean, they cover criminal justice to mental health and substance abuse to labor rights, education. I mean, the list goes on and on. What was the overall tone in, you know, these nearly 1,000 bills that he signed into new law? Is there a larger message when it comes to the governor's priorities?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of big brush takeaways. One is that organized labor saw basically all of its priorities get signed into law by the governor, even though he had vetoed similar versions in the past, which I think kind of underscores that he is really listening to the labor movement. They've had some new leaders take over this year that could have made a difference. Also, that's a, you know, it's a big part of the Democratic Party's base. So he may need to be shoring that up if he's thinking about some sort of national run in the future. When it comes to criminal justice, I think we saw somewhat of a mixed bag. The governor did sign a bill that would basically seal a lot of criminal records for many Californians. It's a very transformative bill. On the other hand, he rejected a bill that would have ushered in the nation's most sweeping transformations to solitary confinement by significantly limiting when prisons and jails and immigration detention facilities could use it. And he also vetoed a bill earlier this year that would have allowed certain cities and counties to set up supervised drug injection sites. So we're kind of seeing a mixed message on that. And then again, with some of the spending bills, although he did definitely agree to sign some bills that would increase costs for the state. He also did not sign many of them, citing these fiscal concerns, and that did strike a more moderate tone overall.
Arguably, the biggest surprise, which really came at that final push on Friday, was signing, or really was Thursday, signing a bill expanding farm workers' rights to unionize. I mean, this was pushed by a more than 300-mile pilgrimage by the United Farm Workers, as well as ongoing demonstrations outside the state capitol. But Newsom at the onset indicated that he wouldn't support the bill, but then that was followed with President Biden and House Speaker Pelosi stepping in, showing their support for UFW. What do you think happened between then and like the 11th hour?
Well, I think definitely having the president of the United States weigh in on a legislative battle probably had something to do with it. I mean, I think the governor realized that the cards were kind of stacked against him on that one. I think there had been such national attention on this bill and on the importance of farm workers, I think, especially during the pandemic when, you know, they were still working out in the fields to ensure that Californians had food on the table, that, you know, maybe slicing that down would not have looked too good for him. But I think what's really important to note about this bill is that although the governor did sign it in this, the ceremony in which he went out to the vigil they'd been holding in front of the Capitol and was hugging farm workers, and they were crying and, you know, very, very emotional. He signed the bill on the condition that it would be very significantly amended as soon as the next legislative session. And it goes into a lot of technicalities about, you know, how farm workers can vote in union elections. But it's this weird middle ground that I think he was trying to walk, where he wanted to show that he was signing the bill, but then his concerns about the integrity of this, you know, mail-in or card check ballot process didn't really go away. And he wants to clean all of that up again next year.
Does this also signal a larger issue of California Democrats striking the right balance between farm workers and the ag industry?
I think definitely. I mean, the agricultural industry is obviously a huge player in California. You know, the governor himself is a proprietor of vineyards for his wine and hospitality company, although that's been placed in a blind trust since he took over as governor. But, you know, obviously California's agricultural industry provides a ton of food for the nation as a whole. And I think with the ongoing drought that has really been squeezing the supplies of water to many farms as well, a lot of growers and agricultural groups are kind of having a lot of pent up frustration about different things. And so I actually think it's very possible we could see a referendum filed to potentially overturn this law, which, you know, many industries have been doing in the past couple of weeks to actually counteract some of the other labor laws that Newsom signed.
Right. I mean, not only with this bill, but also another bill the governor signed, which is a first in the nation attempt to regulate the fast food industry and worker conditions, including wages. I mean, there is a potential referendum in terms of pushback to this bill being signed into law. Was this overall a session of big wins when we're talking about unions and labor, or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah, I think overall it is, but it's actually really interesting. We had a reporter here at CalMatters, Michael Zinstein, who is our higher education reporter. He pointed out that when it comes to private sector unions, which are the ones that we've been talking about, they did see significant gains. But then some of the public sector unions did not. And one very stark example was at the California State University system. There has been a sustained push there to increase wages for non-faculty staff members and health benefits as well. And the governor vetoed a couple of bills, again, kind of citing these cost pressures. And that was, you know, I think what that comes down to is that at the end of the day, whenever you're going to increase labor benefits for a public system, like the public university system, those costs are going to be shouldered by taxpayers and by students, whereas in a company, you know, that might go to their shareholders instead. And so I think the governor is very aware of that, very cautious about increasing those pressures, because he's trying to make college more affordable to Californians. And so those are some of the ongoing tensions that we're seeing on the public sector union front.
Yeah. I mean, other bills that have received widespread attention, including here on Inside, include Care Court, which allows court-mandated treatment for mental illness and substance abuse. There's a slew of bills protecting reproductive rights, also protecting gender-affirming care for transgender youth, but also vetoes like the one you touched upon that would have launched a pilot for allowing safe injection sites. That's something that the governor actually was supportive of in the past. I mean, there is a larger balancing act the governor is striking here. What does this tell you about his priorities?
I think when it comes down to it, the governor is trying to advance the progressive agenda, but he's also trying to come off as a common sense person and a common sense governor. And I think that was really clear in a veto message that I was reading yesterday, or not a veto message, it was actually a signing message, sorry, for a bill that would make it easier for the Medical Board of California to basically punish doctors who are spreading COVID misinformation and disinformation. And the governor signed the bill, but he said that the only reason he signed it was because it's very narrowly tailored so that it only applies to a doctor talking to a patient and not a doctor putting things on social media, for that matter. And he also said, look, at the end of the day, I wouldn't have signed something that was more expansive because doctors need to have the freedom to talk to their patients about the pros and cons of medical treatments that have just come into effect in the past couple of years. And I thought that that sort of, freedom of speech, but at the same time, ensuring that people are not just going out there and spreading disinformation willy-nilly, really underscored the type of balancing act that he was trying to strike in a lot of these areas.
Given that this session is running into a midterm election, which includes statewide races, how do you think that played a role?
Well, I think all of these things are under heightened scrutiny heading into the election because, based on things that lawmakers are voting for or voting against, and based on things that Newsom signs or doesn't sign, all of those things could end up in campaign ads going across the state. And I think, for example, the supervised drug injection sites is a great example because I think that could have very easily played into the hands of Newsom's Republican opponent, State Senator Brian Dolley, or in the future, anyone who's running against him as a Republican who could say, oh, look, Newsom made it easier for people to shoot up in the street and then have pictures of homeless encampments and, areas in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and other places where there are, many people suffering from addiction. And so I think people always have in the back of their mind, okay, how might this look in a campaign ad?
Yeah. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Emily Hoven with CalMatters about the outcome to new laws and vetoes from the legislative session. In the last few minutes we have with you, your newsletter this morning tackles a big issue that Californians feel directly, gas prices. Over the weekend, the governor has made some attempts to alleviate the costs, but the national average of gas, according to AAA, is $3.80. In California, it's $6.38 this morning. That's more than $2.50 in terms of an increase. What is going on with that?
Well, that's what the governor has been trying to figure out. He basically has said, yes, there are certain taxes in California that make the cost of gas generally maybe a little bit higher than the rest of the country. He also did direct the state air regulators to allow refineries to switch to the cheaper winter blend 1 month earlier than usual so they can do that immediately. But basically, they are saying that they do not understand this discrepancy and why it is so large. It's larger than it's ever been, according to the governor's office. And the California Energy Commission actually sent a letter to the CEOs of several refineries and asked them to respond by today, explaining why exactly is it so much more expensive in California, because all of the usual reasons that are cited, it just doesn't add up this time.
Yeah. And now he's taking on the oil industry. I mean, that was what you were reporting this morning as well. What does that look like?
Yeah, he has said that he now wants state lawmakers to send yet another bill to his desk.
More legislation.
never enough. And this would actually basically enact a windfall profits tax on the oil industry. So it would essentially, what he proposed would be capping their profits at a certain amount. And then any money they earn over that would be taxed at a higher rate. And the money would be sent back to Californians in rebates, like the ones that the state is actually sending out this week to millions of Californians to compensate for the higher cost of living with inflation going up. And so we'll have to see if that actually happens. It's worth noting that there was a bill to do that earlier this year in the legislature, and it didn't advance.
Yeah, there's a bigger issue here when you're talking about winter blend and introducing that at a time like preemptively, like early on. Winter blend fuel emits more pollutants, and this goes along with other tricky decisions that the governor has made recently, such as keeping Diablo Nuclear Power Plant open. It was scheduled to close in 2025 due to the challenge of having reliable energy. I mean, there is this bigger issue that the governor faces in compromising his ambitious climate goals to the benefit of immediate livelihoods of Californians.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that was really clear during the recent heat wave when, you know, California's energy grid was pushed to the brink and the governor was afraid that there could be rolling blackouts. And the state actually fired up a couple of gas powered plants to ensure that there was enough energy to keep people's lights on and their air conditioners running. And so I think this is one of the fundamental tensions of Newsom's governorship, is that he has very ambitious goals and ideas. And, you know, many people agree with the concept of those goals. But then the path to that reality is often more treacherous and more complicated than maybe, you know, he makes it seem. And so I think that is something that he's going to have to answer for, not only in this campaign, but any campaign that he runs in the future.
Finally, Emily, whatever happened to gas rebates? I mean, shouldn't Californians be seeing some form of a rebate potentially by the end of the week?
Yes. So the state is, when the Newsom and the lawmakers, they passed these rebates months ago, but they're just now starting to go out. So this week, the state is going to start depositing them into people's accounts that have direct deposits set up with the state. But there are also people that are going to receive them via paper checks. And so this is going to be kind of a rolling process. So some people will see it starting this week, and some people won't see it until January 2023. So buckle your seatbelts. We don't exactly know when they're going to land.
Yeah, it's still a very busy time for you. Emily, thanks for joining us with the roundup.
Thanks so much, Vicky.
Emily Hovind writes the daily What Matters newsletter for CalMatters. Up next, illegal marijuana grows are a serious problem, but the city of Sacramento's enforcement program has been controversial. We'll get an update on an ongoing Cap Radio investigation, now raising privacy concerns as well as accusations of anti-Asian American bias. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Illegal marijuana grows are a legitimate problem across the state. We've had those discussions here on Insight. But the city of Sacramento has been accused of running a controversial cannabis enforcement program, issuing hefty six-figure fines against landlords, even when unaware that their tenants were breaking the law. Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd first started investigating the program a few years ago and recently uncovered new details about how the city has operated an enforcement system with accusations of anti-Asian American bias, as well as claims of violating privacy data. Scott joins us now. Good morning, Scott.
Hey, good morning, Vicky.
So, Scott, since you started investigating the city's enforcement program a few years ago, get us up to speed. What got you into the story and what did you find?
Yeah, we started looking at this, you know, a few years ago, and it first got on my radar when I was seeing dozens of lawsuits filed in Sacramento County Superior Court, filed by property owners against the city. And in my time as an investigative reporter, when you start to see patterns like that of lawsuits filed, that's a pretty good indication that there might be a story there. So I started digging into it further, and I found that the city had issued tens of millions of dollars in fines against property owners. And it wasn't just the overall amount that caught my attention. Each fine was hundreds of thousands of dollars, 200, 500,000. Some of them were approaching $1 million against individual property owners. And, you know, it's important to note the underlying problem here that we're talking about is real. Hundreds of houses across Sacramento have been converted to illegal grow operations in recent years. Police have busted them. You know, that's not in dispute. But where the pushback and the controversy has come in is that the city was pursuing these hefty fines against the people who owned the properties where cultivation was discovered. And intuitively, that seems to make sense. But they were doing it even if these people weren't the ones who were caught growing the cannabis. So our past investigations found that many of these property owners were individual landlords who claimed that their tenants, these sort of rogue tenants, took advantage of them. They said, look, we have leases, we hired property management companies, but we couldn't just walk in the door of this house, even though we owned it, because we were renting it. They said they're being taken advantage of. And it's important to note, for a long time, the city's ordinance basically said, look, if you can prove, even if you can prove that you didn't know about it, doesn't matter. You, the property owner, you're going to get this massive penalty. Meanwhile, we found that the tenants who, even if they were caught red-handed at the house growing the cannabis, they essentially got a slap on the wrist. You know, they might get a misdemeanor, some community service, but that was pretty much the extent of it.
Wow. And you discovered this back in 2019. What caused you to continue following this investigation a couple years later?
Yeah, there have been some notable developments lately. Just in recent days, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a digital privacy watchdog group, they filed a lawsuit, and they claimed that SMUD, the local utility company, the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, has been disclosing customer lists to police to essentially launch investigations into potential grow houses. We were able to confirm that by looking at search warrants. This lawsuit also claims that there are allegations, they allege that there's bias against Asian property owners, that this enforcement system targets Asian property owners and applies these penalties to them disproportionately. We also found that the city separately has made some significant changes to the enforcement program as a result of a settlement that happened in recent months, which gives property owners stronger protections and gives them more tools to challenge penalties if they receive them.
Mm. So we're going to dive into these new developments. But first, I mean, I'm just kind of hanging on these hefty fines that property owners receive. I mean, several hundred thousand dollars. I mean, we're talking about six figures here. Help us understand what happens when a property owner receives one of these huge penalties, because you've spoken to some of these homeowners as well as their attorneys. What do they have to say?
Yeah, let's start with Zuhu Wang. He's a retired bus driver in San Francisco. He's in his 60s. Back in 2017, he bought a house in South Sacramento. His plan was to retire there, but that was still a few years off for him. And his plan was, in the meantime, to rent it out. So he hired a property manager. They did background checks on tenants. They had a lease that prohibited illegal drug activity. Wang himself would drive by the property when he was in Sacramento to keep an eye on it. Nevertheless, the tenant that he rented the house to grew hundreds of plants. Police left a citation on the house's counter for $130,000. And this would have absolutely upended Wang's life. I mean, this was his savings plus some just gone, you know, so this really kind of sent him into a spiral. I spoke to him in 2019 through an interpreter, and this is what he told me after receiving the penalty.
I was very surprised. I was shocked. And, you know, of course, I was scared. A homeowner, you know, has a responsibility. But of course, in my case, I found a company to rent the property out. I went to see the house. You know, I feel I did what I could. I'm a victim here. Me and homeowners to whom this has happened, you know, we are victims and we are the ones who are being punished here.
So Wang ended up challenging the penalty. It was a years-long battle in court. He just recently got the penalty wiped out. The city ended up having to pay $700,000 to him, and a lot of it went to covering his attorney's fees.
Yeah, so that is a success story, although, you know, it took a hardship to actually get to a positive result for Mr. Wang. But this isn't an isolated incident. I mean, you found that many property owners have similar stories, individual landlords who claim that these rogue tenants took advantage of them, turned their rental homes into grow houses. What kind of pushback has the city received?
You know, a lot of people have faced these fines, and it's clear that the city saw this as an opportunity to generate revenue while also clamping down on illegal grow houses, which, again, is a very real problem. Early in the days of the enforcement program, the city had issued $12.8 million in fines, which at the time seemed like a lot. Mayor Daryl Steinberg at a city council hearing said collecting those fines would be, quote, a high priority. And then he went on to say this.
Because that's $12.8 million. And, you know, we're going to have a budget this year that is $12.8 million. We're going to have a budget this year that is going to be lean.
Fast forward to today, the city has issued over $100 million in penalties. But it's worth noting, the city has only collected about 10% of those fines because property owners have been pushing back. The vast majority of them have been challenged through the city's appeal process. And the city is also facing over 80 lawsuits filed by property owners over these fines.
Wow. So that's a lot of pushback. What does the city have to say about the pushback to its enforcement program?
So when I reached out to them in recent days, they declined comment, citing the ongoing litigation filed by the myriad ongoing litigation, but especially the recent lawsuit filed over the SMUD disclosures about electricity and customer data. But Mayor Steinberg previously said in an email to me, quote, there must be consequences for bad actors that are skirting city and state laws. And back in 2019, I interviewed the city attorney for Sacramento, Susanna Alcala Wood. And this is what she said to me about the danger that these homes pose.
It's creating a lot of havoc in the neighborhoods in which these activities pop up, creating an increased danger because of the organized crime activity and the criminal activity that surrounds these illegal cannabis houses. And so we are going to do everything in our power to protect our neighbors.
And so again, the city emphasizes that illegal grows, they're real, they're being busted around the city, they pose a serious risk to communities, to neighborhoods. But again, their enforcement approach has gotten a lot of criticism, and a lot of people have been taking a close look at it, challenging it in court.
Yeah, there's a lot of dispute over who a bad actor is. Is it the property owner, or is it the person that's actually growing cannabis illegally and is a tenant? One notable lawsuit that was filed, as you mentioned, in recent days was by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a privacy watchdog group. It describes how police, Sacramento police, relied on SMUD, that's the Sacramento Municipal Utility District, to launch investigations into suspected grow houses. What does this lawsuit allege?
So SMUD, the utility district here in Sacramento, regularly sends customer lists to Sacramento police, detailing customers who use high amounts of electricity. That high usage is a pretty good indicator that there may be an illegal marijuana grow occurring at a house. And these lists are broken down by zip code, and essentially police would pluck addresses and launch investigations from these lists. And I dug up over 40 search warrant affidavits that confirm these allegations. You know, this was sort of listed out in the lawsuit, and it's reflected in these search warrant affidavits that I found. It shows SMUD was integral to launching investigations into these suspected grow houses. And sometimes these investigations were launched after direct tips or even complaints from a SMUD worker saying, hey, you know, this is an address that we have concerns about. And it's worth noting that in-person surveillance after these sort of lists were looked at and an investigation was launched, in-person surveillance was minimal. You know, we found sometimes there wasn't any. And in a lot of cases, it was essentially just an officer driving by a house and observing pretty prosaic, mundane things about a house, like a fence, maybe a beware of dog sign. In some cases, there were contradictory things that were pointed out as indicating a potential grow house. For example, a number of houses had bars on their windows. When an officer encountered a house that didn't have bars, they wrote in the search warrant application, well, a lot of times, you know, these houses don't have bars on the windows because they don't want to look like a grow house, so they're sort of hiding in plain sight. And so looking through these search warrants was very revealing to see sort of the process from smud lists to a quick drive-by to essentially, let's get a search warrant to go in and raid and bust these grow houses.
Hmm. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd about his latest investigation into the city of Sacramento's cannabis enforcement program for illegal grows. Now, this lawsuit that we're talking about, filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also has allegations that SMUD, along with Sacramento police and the city of Sacramento, were targeting Asian American property owners through its enforcement program. Why did they make these allegations?
So for the first 2 years of the program, according to the lawsuit, 86% of penalties went against Asian homeowners in Sacramento. And just for comparison's sake, you know, the census has the Sacramento's Asian population at about 20%. So that's a pretty disproportionate ratio. Here's Megan Sappy Gao, the co-executive director of the Asian American Liberation Network, which is a plaintiff in the Electronic Frontier Foundation lawsuit.
It's going outside the confines of the law and, you know, scooping up mass amounts of data and specifically target the Asian American community. It's very problematic.
And, you know, their allegation isn't just that these fines were ultimately applied to Asian property owners. They say that the discrimination was baked into the system itself. So they allege that a police officer removed non-Asian names from a list of customers that Sacramento police had received from SMUD. And then there was another incident, and CAP Radio was able to confirm this one. We obtained transcripts and audio from, it was actually an appeal hearing from Zuhu Wang, the property owner who we talked about earlier. And he had challenged his penalty. And during the hearing, a former deputy city attorney, Melissa Bickle, was questioning Wang's property manager, who is Asian. And it's a little hard to hear. Again, this is audio from an appeal hearing, but this is what she said during cross-examination of the property manager.
Now, because you're in the community, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but Asian as well, you know that there is a problem with Asian people and grow houses.
I object to that, Your Honor.
Again, it's a little hard to hear, but she said, quote, now, because you're in the community, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but Asian as well, you know that there is a problem with Asian people in grow houses. And the attorney for Wang immediately objected to that. The property owner pushed back right at that moment. You know, he said to the former deputy city attorney, essentially, no, it's not all Asians that are growing cannabis in houses. Anyone can be doing this, and, you know, anyone is doing this. Ultimately, the deputy city attorney withdrew the question. We reached out to her, Melissa Bickle. She now works for Yolo County. She declined to comment. And we reached out to the city, Sacramento police, and SMUD with regard to, the allegations in the lawsuit. The city and the police declined to comment. SMUD also declined to comment, except to say that they take disclosing customer data seriously and that they follow all laws when doing so.
All right. So there's a lot of decline to comment, but you also found that the city has made some substantial concessions to its illegal cannabis cultivation enforcement system. What are the biggest changes?
So in the case with Wang, as I mentioned before, they settled that case, paid $700,000. Most of it went to attorney's fees. But perhaps the bigger piece of this settlement was that the city agreed to make some systemic changes to its enforcement program. So the police must now send property owners a warning and give property owners 30 days to correct violations before issuing a fine. So previously, police would go in, if they made a bust and they confirmed cannabis was there, they'd count up the plants and leave a citation on the counter, essentially. Now property owners have a heads up to say, or the city says, hey, look, something's not right here, you need to correct it. Gives them more time to respond, kick a tenant out if necessary, and clean up whatever may be happening in the house. The city must also now provide property owners and their attorneys with any exculpatory evidence that points to a property owner's innocence. Previously, the city didn't have to do that. And the appeal hearings now are starting to reflect more of what kind of a court proceeding looks like. You know, this is something, providing exculpatory evidence is something that you would expect in a court proceeding. Now that the city has to do that, it sort of gives a little bit more of an level playing field for property owners who are claiming innocence to try to make their case. Mm.
Finally, Scott, the city of Sacramento is just one of many illegal cannabis enforcement programs across the state. How does this compare to other jurisdictions? Is this a standard or is the city of Sacramento an outlier?
So the city of Sacramento kind of blazed this trail in terms of enforcement when it comes to illegal cannabis cultivation. We found that other cities, other counties were taking a look at Sacramento to see, you know, what was happening here, how was their enforcement program going. Some you know, cities and counties adopted basically mirror images of what the city had done, maybe with a couple tweaks here and there, kind of learning from the pushback from Sacramento. I wouldn't be surprised if some of these most recent developments also maybe make cities and counties look at their own ordinance that have mirrored their programs off of Sacramento to say, okay, maybe to avoid some of the challenges and controversy and pushback that the city of Sacramento has faced, maybe we should make some changes. But right now, you know, we're roughly 6 years into this mass experiment of legal recreational cannabis after voters decided that they wanted to legalize it in California. And the industry is still really in flux. So, you know, even though that we're seeing these changes right now, there's still a lot of illegal cannabis entering into the marketplace. There's still a lot of challenges with trying to direct people to support the legal market and not the black or the gray market. So that's all to say that there's so much flux in this industry that this is, you know, by no means resolved. We're going to continue to see cities and counties trying to work out how do they, you know, clamp down on illegal cannabis grows effectively while making sure that they don't target or penalize people who really are not at fault. And ultimately support the legal recreational market. I mean, it's a tough balance, and I really think that cities and counties have their work cut out for them.
Scott Rodd is Cap Radio state government reporter. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Thanks so much for having me on, Vicki.
We have a link to Scott's investigation, which published this morning, on our Insight page. Still ahead, an Elk Grove teen prodigy who can play over 100 instruments joins us to share their remarkable musical journey. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Many of us know how to play an instrument. Whether done well is up to interpretation. Or you may be like myself, who has a guitar that has become more of a decoration over the years. Well, whether musically inclined or not, our next guest defies what is expected of a single musician. Neil Nayar has learned to play not one, not even a dozen, but more than 100 instruments. He's also composed a score for a short film and has both a new album and a new music book to be released soon. Did we mention that Neil is only 16 years old? The teenage music prodigy has set world records for the number of instruments he's learned to play at such a young age, garnering national attention. To give you an idea of the range of Neil's extraordinary talents, here's a sampling of a few songs from his upcoming album, Breaking Barriers.
Thank you.
And with that, Neil joins us now. Neil, good morning. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Excited to talk to you.
Excellent.
Well, you have said music is your breath. That is such a wonderful way to describe your passion. Where did this all begin?
Well, you know, the story all began when I was in the womb. My dad, he was at the library looking for a book, and he just chose one book randomly. And after reading the book, it mentioned, if you give Mozart music to the womb, then the child will become a musician. So my dad tried an experiment by putting a tiny speaker on the mother's womb. And when I was around 2 years old, my parents bought me a mini drum set from Toys R Us. And my dad said, play the drums. I said, no. And when I was 6 years old, my parents took me to a free drum class. And after one drum lesson, my parents and my drum teacher were shocked. They were like, how did you do this? And then after that, my parents decided to give me another instrument, which was the guitar. And after learning the guitar, that's a spot where I got inspired to learn more instruments. And after that, I went to the guitar, piano, flute, saxophone, on and on and on. And at the age of 12, I made my first world record for playing 44 musical instruments in 2017. And then after that, I decided to break my own world record for playing 100 instruments. And after that, my second world record was for playing 107 musical instruments from around the world at the age of 13 in 2019.
Wow, that is just impressive. I was telling my dad about you, and my dad was like, I can't even think of 100 instruments, you know? And you not only started with the drums, but you didn't just stick with the drums. You wanted to learn as many instruments as possible, and you've succeeded in that. Mm-hmm. Now that you can play more than 100 instruments, do you have a favorite?
I think my only answer is that all the instruments that I have are my favorite. That's the only answer I have.
I can totally see why, because you play all of them.
Yes, of course.
And we're going to listen to some of your music right now and get a taste of just your mm-hmm. talent. The first song we're going to listen to is titled East Meets West.
Yes.
What's the meaning behind the title of the song?
So East Meets West, it means like, you know, that the Eastern music is trying to collaborate with the Western music. Mm. Yeah, that's what it means.
You know, even recently, I mean, your outstanding abilities have earned national attention. You were on Good Morning America.
Yes.
That must have been so exciting for you. Did you expect your talent and your passion to really reach this national platform?
Well, actually, I was not expecting that it will like reach to a national television, you know, which is a very rare chance, you know, to come on. And it's very hard. Yeah.
Yeah, it must have been really exciting. Were you nervous a little bit?
No, I'm never nervous. You know, if I'm, for example, if I'm having like an interview right now, I'm never nervous. Never.
That's great. It's good to be that confident. We're going to listen to another song. This one is titled Spacious.
Thank you.
There really is quite the build-up there. How many instruments did you use to compose this piece?
This one, I think it was around four instruments. It was, first was the violin, then the ziao, which is a Chinese woodwind instrument, similar to like a shakuhachi. Then I used the sarod, which you heard. It's a string instrument from India. And a fun fact about this instrument is that it has no frets. And then... yeah, so I think around like four instruments, yeah.
Is there a song that you have that you've composed that has the most instruments that you've used, or is four kind of like on average?
Well, yes. From my album, it's called Breaking Barriers, and there's one track which has around 107 instruments.
Wow.
Recorded acoustically in one track.
How long does it take to do that? Because you're performing, you're playing all of them.
Yes. Yes, for that album, it took around like 3 months to record that track, like a 10-minute track, 3 months. You know, I had to like bring the instruments from my car to the studio, like going back and forth. So it took a lot of time.
That is incredible. And I can totally understand why your album is titled Breaking Barriers, because you've done that time and time again. And this is just the beginning of you even breaking your own records.
Yes.
We're going to listen to one more song. And this one is called Neil's Vibes. What does this song say about your vibe, Neil?
It's just like a vibe, you know. For the song last night, I was dreaming of like, because you know people say good vibes, right?
Yeah.
And I said, how about I, since this song is created by me, I said, how about I put my name in this one and say Neil Vibes?
Yeah, well, yeah. It feels wonderful. Yes. This Friday, you're actually going to be the official spokesperson for Kids Music Day. Mm-hmm. What message do you want to send to your peers? You know, people who are maybe haven't dipped their toe into music but are interested mm-hmm. in it, and how much it's transformed your life?
You know, I think the message I would like to pass on to the youngsters who are listening right now, I would say... focus on your passion, get it, and have it.
You not only have a debut album, Breaking Barriers, which mm-hmm. is going to be released soon, you have a music book coming out called Passion to Exploration of 107 Sound Machines. And that explores all of the different instruments you've learned to play and you're self-taught. What do you hope readers take away from your book?
Well, I created this book for... kids, teenagers, and adults. And in this book, I described, the history behind this instrument, how it's played, and plus I showed some animation characters of me.
Oh yeah, you brought a copy.
Yes, where I'm like holding the instrument, showing how it's played. And I think after reading this book, I think the audience will have an idea of all the 107 instruments, and will have a knowledge of it too.
This is kind of a crazy question, given that you already know how to play 107 instruments. What do you hope to achieve in the years to come? You're only 16 years old.
Well, you know, I have a lot of dreams which I want to achieve. My first dream is to collaborate with famous musicians, including. Bruno Mars and Adele, Justin Timberlake, and even bands including Imagine Dragons, Coldplay, and even music composers including A.R. Rahman, who composed the music for the film Slumdog Millionaire, which won an Oscar, and one of the top Hollywood composers, Hans Zimmer.
Well, I can envision all of that happening, Neil.
Thank you.
You are well on your way. Neil Nayar is a teenage music prodigy from Elk Grove, sharing his remarkable music journey with us. Thank you for making the trip, Neil.
Thank you so much.
That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minada. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Monday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.